I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Jean Piaget said that play is the work of childhood. Abraham Maslow said almost all creativity involves purposeful play. Ovid said many centuries ago, in our play, we reveal the kind of people we are. And here's a fun quote from Teddy Roosevelt. I believe boys who take part in rough, hard play outside of school will not find any need for horseplay in school. Our guest, Stuart Brown, has thought a lot about play and believes it's essential to our health and happiness no matter our age. He's a researcher, a psychiatrist, founder of the National Institute for Play, also author of a book called Play, How It Shapes the Brain, Opens the Imagination, and Invigorates the Soul. Stuart Brown, a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, real pleasure to be with you, Marty.
This is a really boring way to start an interview about play, but I'm going to do it anyway because I think we need to get a definition from you about what it is that we're talking about. How do you define play?
Well, you know, it's always difficult to define play because it's kind of like trying to define how paint smells. It comes from pre-verbal sources primarily, so those don't always lend themselves to a nice analytic linear discussion. But having said that, I think you can think of play as something that's done for its own sake. It appears apparently purposeless. It's voluntary. It's fun. It can be interrupted. It gives you a sense of freedom from time. And the very thing you're doing or being is the act of it is more important than the outcome. There's usually some improvisational kind of potential within the acts and the experiences of play, whether they're imaginative or a playful game. And the next thing is you kind of want to keep it going or try it again. No, those are just some of partial definitions of this wide mosaic of activities that we call play.
Could we call it also goofing off? Is that play?
Well, it's goofing off if it fits that criteria. If it really kind of takes you out of time and you're not real conscious of the outcome or of yourself, goofing off certainly can be play.
Well, I mean, it's the most obvious when you see children in play or at play, perhaps, you know, making up stories or daydreaming. It's very obvious when we see it in children. I think less obvious if we see it in adults. Does it look differently in adults?
I think it looks differently in adults unless you're in a newborn nursery and you see the relatives and parents at the window making nonsense faces and making all kinds of noises when there's just a little sleeping infant there. So there is a frivolity and nonsense quality that you can see in adulthood. And if you look beneath the surface and people are not too inhibited, often the playfulness that's a part of adulthood has some parallels with the playfulness of kids.
Are we born to play? Are we kind of hardwired for play?
We're definitely hardwired for play.
Why?
Well, I think it's because we have learned through evolution, through millions of years, that to be flexible and adaptable and curious and optimistic about the future, you need to be a player, and that it is wired into, the neuroscientists tell us, into those areas of the brain that are also associated with survival. So it is a survival drive, even though one can live poorly, I think, without it and not die. Whereas if you live without sleep for a couple of weeks, you die. Both of those are survival drives.
And what part of the brain are we talking about here?
We're talking about the brainstem, limbic system, and possibly some of the most ancient portions of the cortex.
You have studied, curiously, interestingly, mass murderers, including Charles Whitman. I don't know how many of our listeners were alive when he went to that Texas Tower and murdered all these people. But you looked at his childhood, I guess, as a way to understand play, or perhaps looking at his childhood got you thinking about play?
Yeah, I might, you know, most of the listeners will not have been around in 1966 when this mass murder took place. But Charles Whitman was an Eagle Scout and had been a scholarship recipient at the University of Texas without a police record. He was married to a town beauty. He went up to the Texas Tower after killing his wife and mother, murdered 14 people, wounded 32. And John Connally was the governor of Texas. He'd been in the Kennedy motorcade. And he was absolutely committed to trying to figure out why this young man who was killed at the top of the tower had done this. So with virtually unlimited funds and talent that we could draw from anywhere, we tried to figure out why Charles Whitman had done what he did when there was no obvious, clear warning to a lot of people ahead of time. And what we found, particularly as we looked through the trajectory of his entire life, beginning almost prenatally, was that there was suppression, intense suppression of his play behavior by a disturbed, overbearing, very, very intense, ambitious father who was living his life through Charles Whitman. So that study sensitized me and certainly the commission to the importance of play behavior, and we felt it was linked to Charles Whitman's inability to handle what was a burgeoning, brooding, vengeance feeling toward the world and others that he hid from the world, but which came erupting in this tragic outflow of violence.
So his father didn't allow him to play, or was his father a kind of a great Santini ordering his child around?
He didn't allow him to play, and there was also active abuse of the mother and some violence within the home. But primarily, the father worked out of the home, and this was in the pre-cell phone era, but he had a CB radio where if Charles and his mother would leave to go to the grocery store, for example, he would monitor them on the phone.
Wow.
And he was, the neighbors who I interviewed and our teams interviewed and the relatives that we interviewed had never seen Charles engage in what they felt was normal childhood free play. Nor did his preschool teachers. So there was really this remarkable suppression in a very bright, very handsome young man and child, this intense suppression of play behavior. So that led to some other studies, and there have been some confirmation that intense suppression of play behavior really is can lead to, and with other circumstances, an outflow of violence.
I mean, obviously, an extreme case here, but what you're saying is that if people or perhaps children are deprived of play, that can have some serious, I guess, health or mental health consequences.
Well, look at what play does for little kids. If you see a kid beginning to explore the environment, reaching out for a mobile when they're infants, beginning to dig in the sand on a beach, they're exploring the possible. They're trying different things. If they're playing with blocks, they knock the blocks down, they pick them up, they put them together in a different form. And when they get into social play, the early play is they begin to learn how to share. And if it's rough and tumble play, there's a huge amount of social learning. The roots of empathy, for example, are learned in natural rough-and-tumble play that's at a preschool age. So it's tremendously important in developing social skills and in learning who you really are.
Rough-and-tumble play can look not like play. It can look like fighting sometimes. I mean, is there something kind of aggressive, perhaps, built into rough-and-tumble play that the kids need to learn?
Well, rough-and-tumble play has a signature that most of us who our adults have forgotten, and unfortunately too many preschool teachers and kindergarten teachers really want to preserve order. Well, rough and tumble play is mayhem. It's chasing, it's squealing, it's punching, it's exuberant. But the people who are involved in rough and tumble play are smiling at each other and stay friends.
Huh.
And they chase and they do all sorts of things that you can hear on a free playground. You can hear the music of rough and tumble play if it's allowed to go on, and it's very important, and it has its downsides and its upsides.
But are you saying that adults are too willing to intervene in rough and tumble play?
I think in our culture, by and large, we want order and quiet. If some of my grandchildren show up at my house and they're tearing around the house, if I had a collection of art, I might be a little worried that that prize vase was going to get broken, and I would stop it. But, you know, basically, I think we as adults need to allow that kind of mayhem to occur within reason. Within, mm-hmm. you know, if it's out of hand and somebody's going to get hurt, the adults have to take over. But by and large, the kids do their own problem solving within their playful capabilities.
So you agree with our former president, Teddy Roosevelt? I believe boys who take part in rough, hard play outside of school will not find any need for horseplay in school.
I think it lessens the need for horseplay in school. I don't know if it completely suppresses it, at least not the school that I remember going to or what I've seen elsewhere.
But what you're also saying is that there is something physical that's part of play, yes?
Yes, I think particularly in childhood, the movement and the activity and the exuberance of physicality is a part of play. But if you're a shy child by temperament, you may not be as physical as if you're some exuberant kid who, you know, is constantly going after whatever is across the street or down the block.
What do you, this is, we could do a whole hour on this. So how does something like video games fit into play from your perspective?
That's a tough one. I think video games, if this question comes up all the time.
I figure.
And I think video games for lots of kids are a lot of fun. And I think the understanding of play that I think makes sense to me, at least, is that play is a state, and put that in quotes, kind of a state of being. So that if you get into what I defined at the beginning of the program as a state of play, you know, it's voluntary, done for its own sake, fun, and it's not driven, and it's not compulsive, it's done with pleasure and with joyfulness, then I think a video game can certainly be a playful experience, and is. But if that video game then becomes compulsive, driven, no longer involves some of those basic tenets about play, but is of a different order, and if it substitutes for physical activity totally, then I think it's crossed the line and is not particularly a good thing.
And we're almost up in a break here. I mean, it sounds like, and this is true for some kids, to the exclusion of other parts of their lives.
Definitely.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Stuart Brown. He's a researcher. He's a psychiatrist, also founder of the National Institute for Play, wrote a book called Play, How It Shapes the Brain, Opens the Imagination, and Invigorates the Soul. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Also open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Well, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, my hometown.
Would you like to see Garrison Keillor live? Well, now you can. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Garrison Keillor, host of A Prairie Home Companion, is coming to the Sands Bethlehem Event Center on Tuesday, November 11th at 7 p.m. Become a WHYY member at the $150 level and ask for a pair of tickets as your thank you gift. Call 1-888-345-9499.
If you want to hang out with me.
What makes an album a classic? Is it the songwriting?
Is it the melody?
Is it the innovation? For Prince's 1984 movie soundtrack, it's all of that and more.
Join Jim DeRogatis and me, Greg Kot, for this week's Sound Opinions as we do a classic album dissection on Prince's Purple Rain.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. There are now thousands of little free libraries, small as birdhouses. Anyone can take books from them. But a 9-year-old from Kansas is now fighting officials who said he had to take his down.
It benefits reading. And as my mom said, it really benefits the community.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. If you're just joining us, Stuart Brown is our guest. He's an authority on play. In fact, the founder of the National Institute of Play. And we called him up to join us in this hour of Radio Times to talk about why play is good for all of us, not just for children. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Bill from Ballykinwood to join our conversation. Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Brown, I have to say, when I heard your description at the head of the show of play, your definition, I suddenly realized that it's exactly the definition of what I do as an artist when I'm creating.
Way to go, Bill.
How do you mean that, Bill?
Yeah, beg your pardon?
I said, how do you mean that?
Well, truly, everything that the good doctor said, I can't remember all of it now, but I stood here in my kitchen and I thought, that's exactly the feeling that I have during the creative process. It's not physically rough and tumble, but it certainly can be mentally. And I think the important thing is the process. Often you don't end up with what you're intending from the start. But still, it's a very exciting process, the act of creativity, a lot of unknowns. And I think ultimately, I tell my students, even if you do a painting that is not one of your best, you've still had a new and unique experience. And you know that the next time around, you're going to have it all over again. And it's a lot of fun.
Well, Bill,
and
a lot of
very satisfying in the end.
And a lot of fun, I think, is one of the operative words. Stuart Brown, you want to respond to Bill's comment?
Yeah, I think Bill has got a good, has come across the way to live life, which is to combine your work and your play and not have them be entirely separate. You know, you just play on the weekend and then you go to work. If you can tap into your own innate desires that really are who you are, which Bill is as an artist, and then implement that somehow in the real world, what happens is that you often are empowered, and the very thing that Bill talked about, the innovation and the creativeness and the kind of the joyfulness in what you're doing, means you're continually exploring the possible. That's part of what play does. So good for you, Bill.
Bill, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me go back to something you were referencing earlier about this sort of state of being and doing something for its own sake. And we've done a number of shows recently about the overscheduled child these days taking all sorts of lessons here and there. Does that concern you?
It concerns me a great deal. It concerns me a lot if a child does not have the time and what really isn't luxury, but the ability to find from within themselves their own motivation and to then allow that child somehow to attune the inner need with the outer world. And when children are at play, that process, particularly if the play is not being controlled or orchestrated by an adult or by a helicopter parent, when they do that from within, you'll see perseverance and increasing skills and a sense of mastery and taking something to the next level and increased curiosity as just a part of that process, which really doesn't need to be over-orchestrated by parents or by teachers or by coaches. So, you know, yes, I'm very concerned that that the well-meaning parent who wants their kid to get into the right Ivy League school and be successful and speak Mandarin by the time they're 10, you know, I think those things get in the way often of what is the spontaneous, biologically driven ability to attune between yourself in the inside and the outside world.
I'm curious what you think, from your perspective as a psychiatrist, what do you think contemporary adults seem to be so anxious about?
Well, I think it's a complicated issue, and each family is different. But I think the perception of danger, I can't let my kid go out on the street, I can't let my kid ride a bus, I can't allow my kid to be in the park by themselves with their friends because there's some pedophile sitting out in the distance. I think the perceived threat is greater than the actual threat in most instances. There are indeed very unsafe areas in the world where kids can't go out and be free and play because it is truly dangerous. But those are the exceptions, and the, you know, our inner cities have much too much of that. But the ability to take risks in a developmentally appropriate way is part of what graduated play teaches us. And when that is interdicted by an adult that's fearful or by a situation that is controlled by the adults, the natural history and the natural trajectory of play behavior is interrupted, and I think there then is a constriction in the life of the child when that occurs. So, yes, I obviously got opinions about this, and it's tough. You know, you want your kid to succeed. You want your kid to get a good grade. You want your kid to behave. You want your kid to, if you're a frustrated father who didn't quite make it to the first string in football, you want your kid to be a football star. You know, all those things are huge motivations on the part of the parents, but they need to be tempered, I think, by looking deeply at what is this child's internal life really like, and what does it, how does it present? And play produces a profile for most parents that comes right out of the kid, and it is their innate talent. So on and on I could go.
What do you do when you want to play or have fun?
Well, you know, I'm an old guy, so it's a little different. I didn't qualify for Wimbledon this year.
Oh, you didn't? Neither did I. I'm so disappointed.
Like 60 years I've been trying. And I have a great partner, and we play tennis, and we are slow-mo tennis now, and more of it is bantering over the net and making fun of the other guy than probably a shot down the line. So tennis is one way. I've got grandchildren, so storytelling and playing with them is really renewing. And I live in a lovely area, so that hiking and biking are for me. And I'm kind of a physical guy, so I like getting out and doing stuff.
But do you see sports that way? I mean, some people play sports really hardcore, and for some it is more just for fun.
Well, sports is it's a complicated issue. If you were to look at kids in Little League or, you know, Pop Warner football or gymnastics, the ability to kind of do your personal best and enjoy that rather than imagining through your parents' ambitions you're going to be in the Olympics or make $10 million as the next person to sign up for the Phillies. And I think love of the game, doing personal best in sports, and a kind of an atmosphere where the outcome is less important than the sport itself, training kids early for that is really, really very important. And the sports world is a complicated world, and I think sometimes it's warfare, sometimes it's entertainment, sometimes it's play.
And that's Stuart Brown. He's the founder of the National Institute for Play, wrote a book called Play, How It Shapes the Brain, Opens the Imagination, and Invigorates the Soul. He's a researcher. He's a psychiatrist. He's our guest on Radio Times. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coame. Let me get Scott from Center City, Philadelphia, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Scott. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks.
You're welcome.
I guess my question for Dr. Brown is I was hoping he could talk about sort of like the biological function of play and like the relationship between play and practice, because I think of like kittens practice like hunting and catching things, and like, you know, rabbits practice escaping and hiding. And if you could maybe connect that to the sort of human versions of play and practice.
Scott, I appreciate that.
Hey, Scott, thanks for the question.
Go ahead, Stuart Brown.
I love the biology of play, and it's a lot of fun. There's a researcher in Northwestern by the name of Jeff Bergdorf who is interested in what's called the epigenesis of play. And he has been able to show that in animal play that can be made objective, that when animals like rats play really hard, and you figure out what that's doing to the brain, it turns on genes in the prefrontal cortex, which is the executive function area, even of a rat. And the rats that play more are smarter, have better memories. Run maze is better. They're more socially adept. So there is a whole biological substrate coming out of largely out of animal play that confirms, I think, for us as highly playful social mammals, that it really has huge functions for improved functioning across the board, brain function, stress management, emotional resiliency. There are lots and lots of side effects that I think are byproducts of play that are really necessary and important. What was the other part of your question?
The other part I had to do with practice and play.
Practice and play. This is a kind of a controversial thing, because if you study things like, if you suppress play in a cat, for example, that cat still has the same skills as a predator. So there's not entirely a correlation between learning to be more adept in the carnivorous world, at least, and playfulness. However, I think the graduated skill learning that is an essential part of developmental play, and it's a part of adult play too. You learn, if you juggle as a senior adult, you're going to be more adept in hand-eye coordination, and you're going to have a little better metaphoric thinking just from juggling. So yes, there are these byproducts that are positive, but there's not a distinct direct correlation, at least in animals, between the play behavior and learning to do what carnivores have to do in the wild to survive. And I spent a couple of years with National Geographic studying animals at play, so this has been a lot of fun to learn about.
Indeed. Scott, thanks for the call to Radio Time. So do you agree with Piaget, who says that play is the work of childhood?
I agree with Piaget's idea that it is a necessary component. I don't particularly like to use the word work.
I was wondering about that.
Because work connotes not something done for its own sake, but something you have to do. And play generally is a spontaneous eruption that produces, mood changes, and which sustains itself. So that work, I don't know about you, but asking my kids when they were young to take out the garbage was not particularly the child's work.
No.
So I think Piaget was on to the fact that play is really important, and the Montessori group have a dictum that is similar. And I think the thinking I would like the culture to engage in is to fully understand sort of the biology and the natural history of play and not separate it from work. And not make, because work in our culture tends to be tedious or necessary or not always much fun.
I mean, work tends to be work, right? That's how it,
yeah.
That's how we often think of it. Let me get Susan from Germantown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Susan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank you for a great show.
You're welcome.
I wanted to mention that years ago, when I felt I wanted to put more fun into my life, I decided that I would take every course that was offered in Philadelphia in improv. In addition, I took courses in comedy, sports, and playback theater. And as a psychotherapist today, I find it essential for couples to learn how to play, to be in healthy relationships. Have done workshops around those themes. But beyond just the fun of it, I think that play helps people be present with regard to their relationships and whether it, over intimacy and just general interpersonal relationships, help people be more mindful and enhances the creative process, as you've already stated. It's helped me tremendously in my work as a writer as well as a therapist. And I'll add one more thing that I mentioned to my clients,
sure.
And that is that there's a little museum in Paris. It's the Picasso Museum. And at the very end of the museum, there's one painting as you leave the doorway, and it's a very childlike painting. Very primitive, and the quote from Picasso underneath states, I've waited my whole life to be able to paint like a child.
Oh, that's great. That's a great quote,
wonderful.
Susan. Yeah, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Stuart Brown, she put a lot on the table, but she talked about couples and the willingness as an adult to be playful and to sort of open up the experience of play.
The, you know, one of the pillars of the National Institute for Play is to bring play into relationships, not just couples, but friendships and, shall we say, Boehner and Reed and Congress and
that
others.
That would be nice.
Where the playfulness as a way of life or as a priority really works. It really allows the sustaining of intimacy. It allows conflict resolution to take place without, you know, a fist fight. And it is a very necessary part, I think. What's the maxim? A couple that prays together stays together. Well, I think a couple that plays together stays together.
And by play, you mean just have fun with each other, do goofy things, goofing off things?
Yeah, I think it's an attitude. You know, if you can not get defensive and have irony about when a spouse or somebody is giving you a bad time, that's very different, and that's very playful, and that's using a lot of the elements of play to sustain the intimacy and to, you know, to lighten what otherwise could become a win-lose argument.
We're almost up on our second break here, but you mentioned work, and I'm sure a number of people listening would say, you can't play at work. You know, work is work. Don't most workplaces want you to, I mean, would have a problem if people came to work with the idea of playing?
You know, I think it's a struggle in many settings, but the most avant-garde or leading-edge corporations who are looking for performance and low attrition and less sick days are finding ways to allow creativity and play to be a part of the workplace atmosphere. It's tough. I mean, there are not all settings that lend themselves to that, but I think that the seasoned managers who wish for long-term sustainability in their corporate activities are learning the importance of play.
Which is to be flexible and creative and open. I mean, I'm thinking of all the things that we've been talking about.
Flexible and open and adaptable and recognizing that someone who is valued and who has a shared purpose with the management and that's in a climate that is light and playful will be loyal and will stick around and work more and will have a sense of belonging, a sense of community within the workspace that doesn't all otherwise occur. Because part of what happens with collective play is that you feel like you belong and you're loyal.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about play with psychiatrist Stuart Brown, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
The Organizational Dynamics Professional Master's Degree Program at the University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY and is hosting an information session on campus Wednesday, July 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. The Organizational Dynamics Information Session will highlight this program designed to prepare management professionals for the evolving corporate challenges that may lie ahead. The Organizational Dynamics Professional Master's Degree Program at the University of Pennsylvania. Details at upenn.edu/dynamics.
The movies Next Stop Greenwich Village, Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, Bloom in Love, Harry and Tonto, Moscow on the Hudson, and An Unmarried Woman were directed by Paul Mazursky. He died June 30th at the age of 84. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to excerpts of the interviews we recorded in 1991 and 99. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Every year, 1.5 million children in the United States experience their parents' divorce. Well, most parents are very worried about their kids' mental health as they go through this process and want to protect their children from the fallout. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll take a look at the real impact of divorce on our children. today at noon here on WHYY FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Researchers are finding the play is not just for kids, it's for adults as well, good for their sense of well-being, for their health, even success in life. Our guest, Stuart Brown, is one of those researchers. He's a psychiatrist, founder of the National Institute of Play, wrote a book called Play and about how it shapes brain development. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Something, I think it was a TED Talk. You've done TED Talks, have you not?
Yes, I have.
You did. And there was a quote from one of your TED Talks: nothing lights up the brain like play, picking up on something we were talking about earlier.
That's, I think, very factual, and the more we learn about brain imaging and the more we see what play is doing through brain imaging, it lights up a lot of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, but particularly the areas that are called associational circuits, so that the new connections appear to be made, particularly can be studied in animal play. Humans have to move around, and the technology's not quite there yet to monitor some kid on a playground while they're tearing around chasing somebody. but the animal play, animals at play, highly social mammals at play, can be monitored, and they really light up with play, more so than virtually any other activity.
Let me get Susanna from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Susanna, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello?
Hi there. Go ahead, Susanna.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead,
Hello?
Susanna.
Shit.
Well, let me pull her down. Let me say what I think she was going to say, which is that sex should be play. Would you agree with that, Stuart Brown?
I would. I think the if it's domination or if it's seduction or if it's, a grim performance activity, that's not very playful. But if it can be kind of interrupted, if it's light, if it's mutual, if it is for the pleasure of both, and if there is this attunement between the two that is playful, sure, sex, playing ball, going to the movies, reading a novel together, those are all playful.
There is this sounds very Victorian, but I still think there are some residuals of this. The idea that when you grow up, you put away your childish things. I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is hold on to some of those childish things.
Definitely hold on to play. I don't think the format and the form necessarily retains itself from childhood into adulthood. I think we all develop through our temperament and life experiences things that retain playfulness, but back to getting into a state of play, that is really important, because if you are in contact with sort of your deep internal playful urges, that's going to lead to your wanting to sustain a state of optimism. It really is a mood alterer, and it is built into us, I think, so we can live in a challenging, difficult world where we all know we're going to die eventually, but nonetheless, here it is. It's there. So, I think it's very necessary in adulthood. I think it's from birth to death. It is built into us, and the biological design of the human, as I've studied it, is to play throughout a lifetime. Happiness is the outcome of play. Think about that. People are often branding things that are supposed to create happiness. I think you've got to get into some kind of state of playfulness for you to seek out and have an enduring, sustaining form of happiness. And that, that's probably controversial, but nonetheless, I'll say it.
Well, we like controversial statements on Radio Times. So are you then also saying that the opposite of play isn't necessarily work, but it's depression?
That's Brian Sutton Smith, the play researcher.
Used to be a
quote,
pen.
And I think it's accurate. I think, I've done around 6,000 detailed play histories in my long life, and I think as you look into an individual life trajectory and see the contributions of play, or see the contributions and consequences of play deprivation, you can see that the play-deprived life always has a kind of a pall of depression. It isn't the biologically driven, serious, suicidal depression that we psychiatrists deal with in the office or in the hospital. But it nonetheless is a kind of a consistent feeling that life and today is today and tomorrow aren't going to be much fun. And when that's the case, there is a kind of a smoldering sense of life being an endurance contest.
Mm. Let me get, looks like Ruth from Germantown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Ruth. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hey there.
I am so happy to be able to tell you about my mom.
Sure.
I had I first thought about her as soon as I heard the word play, because what she would do is she would say, okay, something broke. Let's see what we have around the house that might fit. Or she'd say, you know, you don't need to buy this game. Let's make a clue game. Let's make our own house, and let's think about what little play pieces we have that we can put in it. And she was always thinking that. I find that I do that today, that I go around the house with a renewed look at the common things that you have around the house and be able to say, oh, well, this might work for that, that I'd never thought of before. So the whole creativity thing.
Yeah, the whole creativity thing. Ruth, thanks for the call to Radio Times. It sounds like she had a playful and creative mother, Stuart Brown.
Great mentorship. Nice improvisational creative mom.
Well, which raises the question about toys. And sometimes, I mean, toys are wonderful in many ways. But you think they're toys that encourage play and then toys that not discourage play, but sort of take over play, take the sort of sense of play away from a child?
Well, there's the common joke that at Christmas morning, kids play more with a box than with a toy.
That's right.
I think of a toy as excessively scripted that tells the kid what to do and how to do it, rather than allow the kid to kind of put their own self into the play with the toy. That's probably not as effective a toy as one that fosters the use of the kid's own imagination and so on. So, you know, that's a whole subject in and of itself.
Sure.
You know, how to design and have toys that are play producing rather than having some sort of accomplishment to master the toy or the toy master you. Excuse me.
No, that's okay. I had asked you earlier about video games, and I'm curious about television. We all watch lots of television. Some, you know, some more interesting than others. But do you see that as? I mean, it could meet some of your criteria in that you can get lost in it. Certainly, in some of the storylines. How do you see TV then?
I think it varies. Like with lots of us, it can be escapist, but in the process of spectating and watching and identifying with characters. It's a lot of fun in that. You know, I've been at a meeting this weekend, and there's been a lot of fun made of Sheldon from Big Bang as a character, but lots of laughter associated with him as a stereotype of sort of the overly intellectualized nerd. And so people are enjoying the kind of the bantering about that television program. So sure, they can be lots of fun, lots of play. And also kind of like video games, you can veg out and become mindless and not be really and kind of escapist, which at points most of us need in our lives. But that's, I wouldn't call that, quote, deep play, unquote.
Let me get Eileen from Wilmington to join us on Radio Times. Eileen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have my master's degree in child life, which is working with chronically ill children to help reduce the stress of healthcare for patients and families, and that included play. It was interesting, though, in my life, I am now permanently disabled due to chronic illness.
Oh, dear.
And over the years, as I've had numerous injuries and surgeries and illnesses, I have found that I was limited from my play and found that I did indeed become depressed and have a great deal of trouble coping with my illnesses. Now I do play a little bit of gardening, a little bit of knitting, a little bit of volunteering here and there, and find life much more enjoyable, and find various ways to express my need for play, regardless of my limitations. And I think that's something that a lot of people with chronic illness don't realize that they're missing. So that's
I really appreciate the call, and I think she raises such important points. Let me give you a chance to respond, Stuart Brown.
No, Eileen, I commend you for having the resiliency and the capacity to live with chronic illness and still find your avenues into play, which are really, really important to coping and which really often help the healing process. So certainly the access you have to play will tap into your innate resiliency, and the recreation you find in gardening and doing the other things, even while suffering with some severe illnesses, is partly a way of coping. And I might even add that I've had the experience recently of seeing some activities in Alzheimer's and dementia wards where the past play history of the person that's been overcome by dementia or Alzheimer's is known to the staff, and they then reenact some of the play that occurred earlier in the life. And the response in those instances is dramatic. There's less need for medication. There is less need to cover the agitation. And it has very practical outgrowths, which is sort of part of showing that play is deep, deep in our beings and can still be accessed even when we can't remember 10 minutes ago.
Mm. That's fascinating. I mean, the idea of sort of reconnecting someone with Alzheimer's with their past and what they enjoyed to play, how they played as a kid.
Mm-hmm. How they played as a kid or as an adult, even if they don't have a cognitive particular ability to describe that. Nonetheless, when the staff enacts it and is improvisational with it, with these patients, you'll see a joyful lighting up, and in that joyful lighting up will be less need for medication and less agitation. And, you know, it doesn't reverse the basic process, but it ameliorates it.
Eileen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I wonder, Stuart Brown, if that isn't something we should all remember, which is to make sure we don't forget, I guess, what we enjoyed doing as a kid.
I think the return inwardly to those particularly blissful childhood moments and bringing them back into some form in adulthood that fits us is really, really important, and that it leads to, you know, some good health outcomes that otherwise aren't going to occur. So, you know, you can tell I'm a fan of it.
Indeed. So what did you like to do as a kid?
You know, there was a lot of things. I grew up in the south side of Chicago and was a kind of a social character, so I was always with a bunch of characters, and we'd be riding our bikes to a place called Blue Island or Mount Greenwood, or walking fences in backyards, playing ball on the local field, lots of pickup games. It was my parents didn't have a clue where I was from after school until streetlights went on. And it was a different world then. And that was, you know, it was just, free play was just a part, certainly, of my elementary school years. And I think back to the kids I played with and who they became in their adult life was really profiled beautifully by how we played pickup football or baseball and who did what to whom. So it was a rich, playful childhood, and my parents, particularly my father, was very very playful, so I've had permission.
You've had permission. I guess that's important. Let me squeeze one more caller in, John from Morristown. John, we're almost out of time, but go ahead. You're on the air.
What a great show.
Thanks.
I'm trying to rediscover my playfulness as I get older.
Good for you.
And sometimes when I'm on the golf course, I lose that. But after this show, I think I'm going to remember why I'm there to begin with that social play with cousins and all. And just, Marty, what a great show. Really fantastic.
Well, I appreciate that, John. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. I mean, Stuart Brown, what I see from the callers that we can take and cannot take and the ones that we did, a kind of hunger for play, or maybe even a sense of getting permission to play.
Well, I think in our culture, a lot of us have lost what we had in childhood and have lost play. And if I look at the generational process, I think parents who had more play are often nostalgic for their own kids to have them have more play, and yet the culture doesn't always foster that. So if this program has given kids and parents and adults and older people and more permission to play, it's been really very worthwhile, because it makes a difference in life, and it is, you know, it tells us who we really are and what our talents are, and in a way is allied with purpose. So I look at play as having a component that's got some sacred wisdom in it.
Well, Stuart Brown, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for the opportunity, Marty. It's been a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. He's a researcher, psychiatrist, founder of the National Institute for Play, author of a book called Play, How It Shapes the Brain, Opens the Imagination, and Invigorates the Soul. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant, and I'm happy to announce that John Ahrens is the new producer of Radio Times. He comes to WHYY via WYPR in Baltimore, where he worked for about a decade. So welcome, John. Nice to have you aboard. I'm Marty Moscoen, and thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.